Okay, good afternoon. It's we're a little late here. It's approximately 1:38 on Monday, March 13th. This is a Public Service Commission work session in the Public Service Commission hearing room on the 12th floor of the State Capitol. The purpose of the meeting is to discuss proposed rule changes and some of the comments we received both at the hearing that was held on February 27th as well as the written comments. That the deadline was March 9th, I believe, but it certainly is in the past. So I'm Randy Chrisman, Chairman of the Public Service Commission. With me today is Commissioner Julie Fedorchak, our legal counsel Jack Hsu, and public utility analyst Jerry Lean are here at the table. Steve Call is manning the electronics. Our soon-to-be commissioner, Brian Crash, is in the room. We wouldn't normally introduce guests at this point, but since you're soon to be a commissioner, we're certainly looking forward to having you on board, Brian, and we're not going to leave only one person out since she's Public Service Commission employee emeritus, Casey Fury. So we have, actually, they're both about wind farm rules. We actually have two cases that we held a joint hearing on. One was case number PU-16-775, having to do with lighting requirements, I'll say, to summarize it. And then as part of that change as far as the National Electric Code, the other case is 17-23 on decommissioning rules. And we'll start with 16775, but before we do, Julie, do you have any comments?
I don't have any real big comments, just to say that I think it's great that Brian is here because he's more than likely going to be on the commission when we ultimately vote on these. So I think it's going to be helpful for him to be able to at least listen today to the conversation and some of the issues that we're deliberating with in relation to this rule package. So thank you, Brian, for taking time to be here.
Okay. Well, 16775 is about the lighting. And in both these cases, staff has kind of put together some summaries of the comments, both from the hearing as well as the written comments that were received on subject material that had to do with our cases. We also received some information that did not pertain to these cases, and so those comments just aren't part of our discussion here today. So I'll turn it over to either Jerry or Jack, whoever is going to kick it off.
Sure, I'll start here. So the comments that we received in the lighting case, I'd kind of detail them out separately, but basically they're asking to use technology that's neutral rather than the aircraft detection lighting system that we proposed. And we had a comment from Tradewinds to add language that would say to use commercially reasonable efforts to develop it. We were using that language in the orders, and we didn't have it in the rule. So,
what does that mean? How would that be defined, commercially reasonable?
Well, there were issues raised about trouble getting the there's only one vendor, and so trouble getting them in time to get them installed, or, you know, they might have some difficulties there, or they might have the FAA, which we did say in there, giving them not giving them approval for it.
So commercially reasonable really focuses in on the availability, and it would be different than financially
reasonable.
Or
any other reason that they have trouble getting them or getting them in commercially.
Commercially, like availability of the product and the technology to support it, that type of thing, but not their determination that it's not financially doable.
Well, that's...
Is that a commercial concern?
Questionable. It, you know, I guess somebody could say that it's not reasonable because it's too much money, so it's not commercially reasonable.
That's what I fear.
but they're saying they will use commercially reasonable efforts. And in the rule, we just had a commitment to install.
The commercially reasonable efforts would be something that may have to be evaluated and determined by the commission to see what is a commercially reasonable effort, because that it is a term, it's a pretty common contract term as well. And it possibly could be, I guess the commission could determine it in a number of different ways, whether financial, commercially reasonable financially would be taken account or not.
Mm-hmm.
But this is just a policy criteria when we're looking at this. So really for a commitment, the ones that really stuck out to me for this is the making it more generalized,
mm-hmm.
so you can incorporate lids and stuff like that into consideration. So I think the term light mitigation device was brought up during the hearing. I don't have it written down
Lighting mitigation technology.
Right.
Yeah. I thought that made a lot of sense. I mean, that's a very positive change in my opinion. The commercially reasonable is a little bit of a cause for concern, and I hadn't actually focused in on the fact that that's the terminology we used in our orders. When I looked back and read that, I was a little bit surprised, even though we went through it, so I'm not saying it was my own fault for not remembering it. But I don't sense that the companies are resisting this a lot, and they want to adopt it, so I'm somewhat comfortable going along with that term. But we would always have that discretion, whether it's stated or not, right?
Think you have, you know, whether or not it's commercially reasonable or not.
You know, I think that the commission, of course, the concern always, or a concern always can be from industry's perspective, well, but the commission might change.
Right.
But the commission, as it currently stands, I think we've already shown that we take that into consideration, or when you so wisely brought this to our attention, we'd have required it immediately.
Yeah.
Said, just do it. But we recognized that it probably wasn't commercially feasible right now.
Yeah.
And as Jack said, we're not requiring it. It's a
policy consideration.
Yeah.
Something that the commission will review. And it could be a commitment to make commercially reasonable efforts, or it could be a commitment to actually do it.
Use. So would if we were to entertain the commercially reasonable language, would it state something like a commitment to use commercially reasonable efforts to install light mitigation systems for wind energy conversion facilities subject to FAA approval? A commitment to use commercially reasonable efforts? That seems a little bit more, it seems like a little bit more couching than is needed in a policy criteria. Could be something like a commitment to install light mitigating systems for wind energy conversion facilities subject to commercial availability and FAA approval.
You know, if it's not commercially available now, I imagine as it gets more popular and required that, and we get more entrance into the technology field doing it, that it's going to be a whole lot easier to get.
Yeah.
So I don't know if we want to be specific.
On the other hand, you know, if with something relatively new like this, are there patents that are going to protect it for a while?
There might be on the radar stuff, but the other one they were talking about, the LIDS technology, is different. I wouldn't. Maybe they might patent that, but
right. Well, I'm not opposed to recognizing that commercial availability of the product is a factor that we would consider and use in any determination for a deadline for implementing this on any future project. We've already shown that to be the case. So
do we want to write in something that the commission will take into consideration availability or something?
I was thinking just use commercially reasonable efforts or just take it out completely, I guess. But it's up to you.
I like the second phraseology better, commitment to install light mitigating systems for wind energy conversion facilities subject to commercial availability and FAA approval.
Okay.
Then it's the availability of them. It isn't their efforts to determine whether they're available.
Well, if they're not available now, I mean, I'm thinking that put them in when they become available then.
Right.
So, I mean, soon. Yeah. So, I mean, you still want them.
Yeah.
But there's some things they need to do, I understand, when they're putting up a wind farm. To make that radar system work if they're going to use it, and it makes it more expensive if they don't have those things in, so they should be preparing for that.
Mm-hmm.
I think the one thing, who knows what the commission will make up will be at that point, will there always be, just like now it's not the light detection system, now it's something new. Will there always be another thing on the horizon that, no, we shouldn't use what's available now. We should wait. In just a couple of years, there'll be this better thing.
Yeah.
And so that becomes the ongoing excuse to never do anything because there's always something better and more efficient on the horizon. And so at some point, you know, something will have to be done to trigger action.
Well, and I think that'll be up to the commission in every case to kind of say, nope, this is the deadline. And
I don't know how we really write that in to the rules at this point that no matter what's available at that point, they have to do it,
Right. Well,
be reasonable commissioners all the time.
Probably not as reasonable as us, but I do think you set the standard.
Comfortable with
I am
understanding here, and then there was that electrical code, and I don't recall any controversy about it either written or stated.
That's pretty routine.
Okay, good.
Anything else on 16?
There was just the one
75.
There was just one change, commissioner, to the selection criteria. If you recall, to change, before it was just, I believe, noise-sensitive land uses, but we also added or light, and I think we're, during the Jerry's testimony, he said he was going to move it down to a separate subsection. So even though it says noise or light, it'll say noise-sensitive land uses, and right below it, light-sensitive land uses.
Okay.
So we would separate those into two different sentences, say the same. One noise, one light.
All right.
Okay, and that covers 16.775 then?
We're half done.
We're half done, right? Okay, so we'll move into 1723.
Okay.
And do you want to just work through them section by section as they are now, or how do
I
you want to do that, Jerry?
I could do that. The comments or summary is subject to,
so your summary
is that way. That and So I just
bogged down. I might skip around and go take some easy ones and get them off the table. But I'll just start with one then.
Okay. So I'll just go through that summary document.
Sure.
You know, we did get comments on things that weren't relevant,
yep.
And I didn't put that in here. The first section we
I
had,
do though, in case those are listening that sent in comments on issues that aren't directly addressed in this rule package, yeah. Those are informative, at least for me, in terms of what other rules we might consider in the future. And so I would say that those folks, if they're listening, shouldn't feel like their comments were wasted. Those will be things that I look back on and think about, because this won't be the last rulemaking on wind siting that we're probably going to do. It might be the last one for now, but I would envision down the road we'll be doing some more, especially in light of what the legislature is doing and probably going to be asking us to do. So thanks, Jim.
And that is a good point. Like, it certainly was useful.
Yes.
It just isn't used on this particular case.
Yeah, and I found them useful as well. The first paragraph is just landowners supporting the rule changes. So there's like four of them that supported all of the decommissioning, lighting changes and stuff. The first section was 6909.01, and that was the definition sections. And so we had Red Butte Wind LLC, which is a subsidiary of Tenasca, and they were working on a project here somewhere in the state. So they said construction should be defined in the rule to exclude activities incident to preliminary engineering or environmental studies. And, you know, we have it defined in the statutes, and we don't have that exclusion in the statute. However,
where is it defined in the statute? Earlier in,
I didn't write it down. 49, 2203.
And what does that apply? What's the context of that? What are we saying about construction in the statute?
There, we're defining it for the statute, and if it's construction, they need
for
a permit.
For
yeah.
Siting, not
no, for siting, and this is in the siting chapter.
So really, by the law, if we're to enforce that, they should have their permit before they can even do their preliminary engineering or environmental studies?
You know, somebody could interpret it that way. And so it wouldn't hurt to clarify it.
That's circular.
Yeah.
You couldn't get it.
Yeah.
Permit without the engineers.
And so I don't interpret it that way. I tell them when you start construction, it means you start turning dirt. And they say, well, you know, we're shoving a Met Tower in the ground. Is that turning dirt? And I says, well, I don't think so. So, so yeah, it could be defined.
Okay, but wait before you go off of that. So, Jack, does that definition apply to this then automatically, or do we need to restate the definition?
It wouldn't apply automatically. We could put it in there, but it would be subject to the commission's interpretation, and I don't believe the commission has ever interpreted it, studies, preliminary studies, to be included in construction.
Okay.
And also, it's not a decommissioning issue either, really. I mean, that's construction's done by then, I hope.
Well, it is in the sense that these rules trigger bonding before construction. So does it, is it, do we need or not need a definition of construction in the rules?
It seems to me like it would be easy, pretty easy to put in there at this point.
It would be a simple
either
change.
A definition or I don't know if it's elsewhere in here, but I had looked ahead to subsection 06, which happens to also be on page 6, and what they're getting at here, the sentence starts out prior to the commencement if this is adopted, it would say prior to the commencement of construction of a facility. If we didn't want to add it to the definitions, I suppose we could put something in there too that excludes the pre-engineering and environmental study.
I liked what they were suggesting, just copying
just
it.
Putting a definition in?
Putting it in the definitions.
We can
Whichever way I think is fine with me, but I mean, it certainly is the intent, and so.
Yeah, so it would be either 9 or substitute it in there someplace in that section of definitions.
Probably become the new 4 or 5.
Then everything would jump down. Okay.
Okay. MDU requests existing facility be defined as a facility for which a site certificate was issued prior to July 1st, 2017.
I read that a bunch of times and couldn't see the difference.
The difference is now I think an existing facility is defined as one that was constructed prior to July 1st, 2017.
Well, our definition that I'm looking at in the proposed rule said existing facility means a facility for which a certificate of site compatibility has been issued prior to July 1st, 2017. So were they just maybe looking at an old version of the rules or something?
Maybe they were looking at another section down there where we had that issue about the whether it's construction or when the certificate is issued thing.
There is the one portion of moving it down from 3 to 4 feet where it's constructed after that date and not an existing facility. If you look under sub 6909-0905 sub 3.
What page is that then, Jack?
That would be page 6.
On or after July 1st. So
that's what I was remembering.
That would be anything that isn't an existing facility.
If this is anything that hasn't been constructed prior to that date, whereas existing facilities are for the financial assurances board.
Right. And
the point of that distinction there is, you know, we have one or more in the process of being cited that don't even have intention to build this year.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they might as well dig down an extra foot before they start pouring concrete and do it correctly, even if they already have their permit.
So
it's very simple to make that change and
so
with
sure,
one
so
exception on the concrete removal,
Just
go down an extra foot.
And so the other thing they said is that the existing certificate conditions shouldn't be modified. So that must be what they were talking about.
So
when
they would
issue a certificate, the conditions, they start planning on those conditions or something and think that that's what should stand.
Well, so you want to tie to the construction, Randy, in this case because of
only on that 4 foot.
Right. I mean, it seems reasonable. But MDU is thinking that's a big deal?
I don't know how big they said it, but it was in their comments that I don't know how big a deal it is for them, but it's not for them to comment on.
Well, I'm fine with it.
I'm not sure if I remember correctly, but I thought they just wanted these to be prospective. So they didn't want to have to go back and change an old certificate. Is that right, Jerry? Maybe did I read that incorrectly? I only read through it once.
I don't think they're changing the certificate, but...
Right, so we didn't want this to be retroactive.
They want the conditions to apply that were issued with the certificate and not modify them with this rule.
Has MDU even had another wind
Thunder Spirit.
All right, the one that's already operational. Oh, I
see. Oh, the ones that be.
Which they're in the process of.
Oh, sure, that's why. Because that certificate that they have is 3 feet.
Yeah.
And they don't want to have to apply 4 feet to the new portion of that.
Yeah.
They said here, it is important for the company, its customers, that the conditions under which a certificate was issued not be modified prior to completion of construction. Doing so could cause construction delays and increased costs that may have been avoided if known at the time the site certificate was issued.
So I'm guessing they have their Thunder Spirit designed now already, and it's designed with cables 3 feet down.
And this would just, what now?
It required them to remove those.
No, this would just
cables.
Cause them to take out 4 feet of the concrete.
Oh, wait a minute, wait, not cables.
On decommissioning.
Cement.
That would be.
It just makes them take another foot out.
2-4 feet.
Right, but for decommissioning?
Yeah, I remember. The cables aren't affected. They're only going to have to go down 24 inches in those.
So how would that affect construction now?
I don't think it would affect construction. It makes their decommissioning more.
I think the deal is they're never going to remove the concrete. They're going to bury the concrete deep enough so they don't have to. So this would require them to go down another foot.
Well, that's how the cable works, but the concrete they'll have to remove down. They can't bury that deeper. And
why?
It's the footing for the wind turbine.
Yeah, and if you put 3 feet of dirt over the top of it, then it's 3 feet. Then
you think they're just going to mound it all up everywhere? They're going to mound the bases up with dirt?
Yeah, I see what you're saying, Randy.
That's, you know, very, very large.
They'd give you
far enough that they don't have to remove it, and there will be less, you know, more similar to the base that sticks up, going for 3 feet or 4 feet.
So their base looks like this and then spreads like this. This portion that comes down here, they would make that a foot taller, is what Randy's saying. That way they wouldn't have to take the base out.
Right. Do we know that it's 4 feet where the base spreads?
I think it's site-specific.
The ones that I recall looking at, that's just...
I've seen 3 feet.
Interestingly, Jim Roars, who does a lot of construction, said, this is not a big deal, taking out this concrete.
Well, no, that gets, I guess, moving ahead to the 8-foot thing.
Yeah.
You know, when the mines hit rock, you put some dynamite in, blow it up, and...
Yeah, he said once you've got that equipment out there, you should take all that. I mean, that was his, and he's pretty sympathetic to being reasonable to the wind industry, I think. But he said once you've got that equipment out there, digging out that concrete is not an onerous task. And he looked at the cost that I had gotten on decommissioning from from Excel, and he said, you know, he even pointed to it in their estimates that it's not a material cost. So anyway, I would be open to the 8-foot consideration down the road probably, but as far as this affecting MDU's project at Thunder Spirit, I guess I'm not really seeing it on a construction site. I mean, they just have to prepare for reclamation in 30 years.
So it sounds like no.
Well, that's, I mean, that's
I'm comfortable
my sense.
With this one as it is. You know, yeah, I suppose it will make some difference. You have to recalculate that and work it if they're going to do it different or prepare to remove a foot in 30 years from now. But also leaving it. Unless somebody invents a new way of putting in fence corners, it means even fencing corners can't be built there for forever.
Yeah.
You know, that's something, too. That's why we're doing this.
Right.
These are significant implications. And for a long, long time.
Mm-hmm.
This is the first work session, so we can still discuss this and come back to the second one and make a final determination. But right now, you want us to work on it as if the 4 feet?
I think so.
So I'm just going to write a no by MDU's suggestion. it's already defined that way in the beginning, and then we're on the, what we're proposing for the concrete removal. Okay, so our next issue was 690903.
There was, just to keep in order here, 02, there was just nothing.
Let me see what that was.
Oh, that's just that the owner's responsible, not the operator, so that's why there was nothing.
Okay. Where, let's see.
Because I didn't recall anything on that subject either or have any notes, so.
Yeah, no, we had no comments on it.
But where did you get, where did you capture MDU's comment about the professional engineers?
That's a little problem.
I don't know that I see it on.
Oh.
Yeah.
6 and 08.
Oh, 6 and 08.
Yeah.
The very bottom of Jerry's second page.
Okay, sorry. All right, we'll get to that.
Okay, so jump into 03 then, Jerry.
Okay. 03 was setting the 10% minimum capacity factor. And NextEra said the minimum level was not needed because owner will likely lose money and not receive any benefit from delaying decommissioning. They're saying that it costs them money to have it sitting there. They'd rather decommission it up front anyway if they're going to decommission it. They're concerned with the potential for being forced into a premature decommissioning. And it's subject to rebuttal. But I think they're concerned about, that doesn't necessarily mean that the commission wouldn't require the decommissioning to begin when they're not ready for it. They may be intending to repower it, so it adds an uncertainty to their projects that they feel isn't necessary.
Yeah.
Red Butte, retaining the current language was their suggestion, which is generates no electricity for a continuing period of 24 months. And then that's the rebuttable 10% creates uncertainty and should at least include an express exception for catastrophic or force majeure events.
I will say, I think that subsection 5 down there, where we've built in the presumption, may be rebutted, covers all this. If for some reason catastrophic or force majeure events aren't covered, I don't mind adding those words. In fact, it seems to me it goes against their interest, because if you highlight that as the reasons, it seems like to me like it would almost lessen the likelihood that the commission, if this ever comes up, would give the exception for anything else. So I'm fine with adding those words in there, but I tell you, this is maybe the heart of the whole effort, because without this minimum factor, I get their point about they could be losing money, but if somebody's losing money or is broke, and you're already having a problem with that, you're losing money, you probably don't want to go out and pour millions of dollars into reclaiming an area. And so the solution could be to just find somebody and trickle a little power out every couple years and reactivate it. There has to be some minimum standard. And if we didn't do that for the coal mines, nothing would ever get reclaimed. It would always be, well, we're coming back when it's a bigger area and we can use larger equipment and do it more efficiently, but we don't allow that. And I just, like I say, I'm okay with adding the whatever the word was, the catastrophe or calamity or whatever, but I would not support removing that minimum production requirement.
Okay.
one thought I have with regards to that is unforeseeable events that may cause them to be unable to fulfill their contracts, that may be falling under force majeure clause. Would it be something with regards to a manufacturer stop, stopping their manufacturing of certain parts or certain turbines and stuff like that? I know in various wind farms around the country that has been an issue in the past. I mean, and probably not in the last decade, but in the past that has occurred, and there were no replacement parts. And what they started to do, was, if I understood this correctly, cannibalize the existing turbines to the point where they're only running a portion of the wind farm. And with that in mind, the 10% capacity factor would make some sense, that you're just not cannibalizing to the point where you're just dribbling out power. So I don't know, that's just something that may occur.
And if the horizon is such that, yes, if we could just wait one more year, right, these parts are going to be available, to me, it's just so well written here that they just file a plan for commission approval then that outlines the steps to continue construction, mm-hmm, or operation.
And yeah, and their point being, what if the commission don't approve their plan?
Then maybe it's not a very good one.
Right.
It's one way to look at it.
I mean, no matter who's sitting here,
certainty comes from on their part that it's a new uncertainty for them.
Well, and that has to be balanced with the uncertainty that exists for the landowners who have structures on their land, mm-hmm, that might run for a couple days every 24 months and wondering, when are they going to come down? It's not being used. Or the uncertainty of what's happening to this company. They don't seem very financially strong. Are they going to have enough money to decommission these facilities? So I think it's a balance, and I think we've got a really good safety net there with a conversation that can exist between the company and the commission, and you can talk through all the factors at play and come up with a reasonable, okay, solution. So I think that I support the addition of the force majeure clause as well, and then keeping it at the standard that is laid out here, because I do think it's a reasonable one.
Okay. So
and just in general, because so much of this is new, cutting edge, never been done before, I like the components that allow conversation and flexibility rather than defining everything in writing and trying to imagine what's going to be happening, when the reality is none of this has ever happened. So we don't really have anything to base it on. So I like this, and there's other things coming that are kind of similar to it that set up a conversation between the commission and the companies to come up with a good plan for some of these issues when they happen.
So we will add the force majeure language and keep the 10%.
I'm fine with that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But go ahead, Jack.
I was just thinking, one additional thought. Before, we had the 24 months with no energy being produced. What if it was 24 months with reaching the 10% capacity, not reaching the 10% capacity factor? I mean, if there really is one catastrophic event, it seems like within 2 years, it wouldn't be inappropriate to have to come in front of the commission and with a plan to get it back moving again.
Well, are you trying to get away from the 10%?
No, it would just expand it to 24 months as opposed to...
No, it's a year.
A one-year capacity factor.
Where are you at?
If you look at... 03, it says a facility is presumed to be at the end of its useful life if its annual capacity factor is less than 10%. But the concern is 1 year with a catastrophic event and then having to come back and get regulatory approval. If it was 24 months, as it was with the old rule with no energy being produced, if it was 24 months...
For the capacity factor.
With a capacity factor of less than 10%.
But they have to file the annual plans.
Right. Well, they could still do that, and we could monitor for a period of 2 years. But it was just something to toss out.
Well, I like the conversation that exists between us and them. If there's something catastrophic that's happened that has made a facility not have capacity factor higher than 10% in a year, it seems like a reasonable thing that we should know about that. And that would trigger this conversation. So, again, no,
depend on when in the year the thing screwed up.
We're getting filings from the utilities all the time on different things like this. So maybe the companies just aren't as familiar with how routine it kind of becomes.
I mean, they will know by fall that they're on the edge of this, right?
Yeah.
You know, so the calendar year that we're talking about, it's not like they get to the 31st and suddenly realize that that thing didn't work all year. They'll know leading up to it.
Yeah.
And then there'll be whatever the time frame we decide on to turn something in. And then if they have a chance to rebut it. And as we got the right now, it's 8 months, but there was a comment to extend that to 12 months to start. And so during that time, there can be more discussions. And so I don't know. I just think this part of it was well written, with the exception of the catastrophe or force majeure.
What are you thinking about the 24 months, Jack?
I was just thinking the 24 months because that would actually mirror what we have currently with no energy, but now it'd be 24 months.
With the 10%.
With the 10% capacity factor. So there, I believe it was Red Butte that cited the fact that a catastrophe could occur 1 year and they couldn't meet the 10% capacity factor. That was their concern, they immediately have to come back in. And I know that, Commissioner, that you're agreeable to that, but I was just thinking, you know, give them the opportunity not to require commission approval if they can get that up and running again in 7 months at full capacity again.
In 7 months, or?
Well, it was just, that was an arbitrary date, but by the next year and reach the 10%, as opposed to having to run back in to get regulatory approval, if they just immediately get working on it again so they can hit the mark next year.
So they're thinking that they wouldn't make the investments until they got approval from us because we might make them decommission?
That was, somebody said that. Yeah.
I think that was an MDU comment, yeah.
Oh. And that would make sense. I mean, they would be sitting waiting on the commission to act before they'd order parts or whatever they needed, thinking, we're not going to do this if we have to decommission.
Well, I mean, if there's a solution at hand for making a facility operational, why on earth would we require them to decommission it?
Yeah, but, you know,
I mean that's like taking a power plant down.
Nervous.
Well, but you know, also, like I said, they can come in, they could be coming in before the end of that year with their plan. You know, we know this hasn't been working, and here's the parts we're waiting for, and here's why we think they're going to ultimately be available.
What if we split the difference, go 18 months?
It'd be difficult to determine the capacity factor for the next year.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Capacity factors.
All right.
But I don't think anyone suggested that, Jerry, did they? No. That was just something I was thinking from reading the difference between the current 24 months with no
right
energy production and what we currently have.
Well, I like the 10%, not no, I mean, as compared to no energy production. So whether that applies to 1 year or 2 year, I guess I don't think it's a huge difference.
Let's leave it for now.
We can talk about it the next one.
If we decide to, we can come back to it.
Okay.
Yeah.
But the big thing to me is the 10% versus no energy reduction.
Yeah. You will add that catastrophe and force majeure part, right?
Yep.
And where does that go?
I thought we would put it so that in the beginning, like area, just hadn't thought it all the way through yet, but so that there's an exception that if it's a force majeure or something like that, it doesn't even apply to them. They don't have to decommission. They don't have to ask for rebuttable.
I think that'd probably end up being a sub 4 under
03.
Or in that area, or under sub 3. Either its own, subsection or probably added on to 3 or 4.
But they will still need to get commission approval that it is a force majeure event.
Yeah.
They don't just get to do the labeling, I wouldn't think.
Okay.
A facility can receive an exemption for failing to meet the threshold due to force majeure or catastrophic events, something like that added to number 3.
That was the one I didn't really like because it's tended to limit it to force majeure events the way word it like that.
That's what Red Butte used. Express exception for catastrophic or force majeure.
Yeah, so that means exception to the whole thing, I think, for a force majeure event.
What do you suggest, Jerry?
I have to look at the... except in the right in the first words, except in 6909-0904. With the exception of force majeure or catastrophic events, comma, facility owner shall begin decommissioning. Whoops, never mind.
Well, maybe you guys can just figure
out. We need to address that in both 03 and in 04.
I don't believe anybody requested it with regards to construction. There were no comments in that regard.
So how about if we just stick it in there and then...
I'm still not quite... What page, Sherry?
Next work session.
Page 4.
Page 4 where?
It'd be under sub 3 and sub 4.
End of where?
The end of useful life. I think when they were speaking about the force majeure, they were speaking with regards to not being able to meet the 10% capacity factor due to a catastrophic event like a substation or something like that.
That's where I had just suggested, and Jerry said he didn't like it.
Okay.
He was suggesting something else.
I'm not sure. I have to think about it when I read the thing. And
yeah,
so
that's fine.
We
can come back to that.
If we put it in there where you want and see how that goes.
Okay.
Where were you thinking force majeure, you said, in subsection 3?
We'll come back with something for the commission in the next work session.
Right, subsection 3 here.
Okay, is there anything on 4 then? On subsection 04? I guess also on page 4.
One thing, it looks like I was doing this summary. I put MDU under 05 for this end-of-life stuff. And so the
should have been up under 04.
Yeah, and we just talked about it.
All right.
Yeah.
Oh, what about their that's the next one. The landowner stuff. Yeah. Okay.
So that's getting into 05 then.
Yeah, let me see 05. The Okay. So NO5 MDU was concerned about the language about the landowners.
Yep.
So considerations to be given to landowner preference and specifics of lease agreement regarding restoration and reclamation to approximate original topography. And we had the...
In subsection 4, they were suggesting, right?
Yeah, original...
MDU, I think they were focused on subsection 5.
Grading and...
Yep, not for this one.
Unless the commission approves an owner request signed by the applicable landowner.
Yeah, but I don't really see it in the rule just there, and it's down in 05.
Well, no, the original topography that existed prior to construction of the facility with topsoil respread or register in number 4.
I mean, I suppose it could be a discussion point there, but then it's directly discussed in 05.
It seems to me that we're...
Oh, you're saying you've addressed it.
Yeah, we've addressed it in 5. Yeah. We require commission approval of it. If they're putting something in their lease agreements that it's going to be this way or that way,
mm-hmm.
and then the commission says no afterwards, they would feel like the lease wasn't...
Seems like it's addressed.
So in the leases, future leases, they may need to say subject to commission approval or something like that. I don't know.
Well, they may, but I'm guess, you know, in advance of these things, I'm guessing if someone is building into their lease that a road is going to be left, then that's probably, you know, that would be the kind of thing that the commission would, I'm sure, approve.
Yeah.
And nobody's going to build into their lease that you can just leave everything all disrupted and give me the cash that it will take to reclaim it because I'll be retired by then. You know, that's not going to be in a lease anyway. And that's what we need to prevent. You know, the last time that we had a big mine reclamation case where we had to go in and do what the landowner didn't want to do it.
Yeah.
So if I'm hearing right, no change?
Right. Because it's already been addressed.
Yeah. So the Mills family, there was like 3 sets of comments from them. And
are you still in 05, or have we moved on from that?
I'm still in 05.
Okay.
And Mills family's under MDU there.
Mm-hmm.
So subsection 2 should not require removal of cables to any depth. It's not required for other utilities. So they made the point that just leave the cables down there. But, you know, the reason that we had a depth requirement on those cables was that gives them added incentive to bury them deeper. It wasn't so much to have them take them out. It was to have them bury them deeper. And so they're going to bury them deep enough that they don't have to take them out.
Yeah.
And
so
that is
covered.
A great point. I'm sure, you know, when they're down there and abandoned so that they're not a danger anymore, I'm sure the best decision will almost always be to leave them.
Yeah.
I mean,
why disrupt
dig it all
the ground
up.
Again?
Yeah.
But you want them buried deep enough so that people aren't hitting them by accident, even though we encourage them to call before they dig.
Exactly. They might not be able to find it.
So no change. David and Vicki Carpenter supports removing all the concrete, not just to 4 feet.
And that's the next 3 are saying basically the same thing, all 3 of those.
Yeah.
And Jim, so 4.
Yep.
Yeah. If we were to do that, just curious, would that require a new hearing since it's a change to what the rule is?
Exact question. I think it's pretty substantive, though.
I think that's a fairly large change.
Mm-hmm.
Probably we would probably want to reopen that portion just for, to receive additional comments with regards to that.
Right.
So my I'm going by memory, but I think the last one of these that I looked at real closely, and I don't remember if that was one that was, you know, designed that they were planning on removing to 3 feet or 4 feet, but that's really where the big pad started, at either 3 or 4 feet. And I think it was like a 7 foot thick piece of concrete. And so, you know, it's probably the bottom of it goes down, you know, maybe 10 or 11 feet, 12 feet. And so to require removal to 8 or 9 feet, you might as well say you're requiring removal of it all. So
I
think it's, you know, the 4 feet, I continue to think makes a great improvement in mm-hmm. at least on the fencing end of it. It still wouldn't allow pipelines, still wouldn't allow someone to build a house there someday or something like that without industrial type of equipment, but at least it would allow fencing. And so the next step would be to remove it all. 8 or 9 feet is almost the same. And I think, too, I would hate to see this get devolved into a time-consuming thing over that one change. It might be something we want to address in a future rulemaking, but I think our initial effort of 4 feet is a vast improvement, and I'm fine with it.
That's where I've been going to do move it through this time with 4 feet. We can contemplate it in the future again and get comments from at that time from the industry on what that would involve to go to 8 feet and how much it would cost and what the advantages would be from the public standpoint. So
the company would still be bound by the law of the lease as well. Any sure. landowner could negotiate to that point, but that kind of goes to what Mr. Melchor was writing about having everything filed with the map showing the survey location. That wouldn't be a bad thing to look at moving forward.
Another thing that Jim Melchior said was there should be a requirement to file a map showing the surveyed location and depth of all remaining buried waste after decommissioning. That seemed to me like a local requirement.
I thought that was a good requirement.
Yeah, register of deeds or something like that when they, on the easement mm-hmm. type thing. I might be wrong, but it just seemed like that's where that would belong in the county level. We generally don't do anything with land encumbrances or anything like that.
Jack, do you have thoughts on that from a legal standpoint?
I think I'd have to go back and look through the law and see if that would really be something that we could require.
Okay.
Or that would require a statutory change.
It's a good point because, you know, if you're going to be leaving stuff, someone ought to know where it is. So a lot easier to do that at the time than to try to recreate it 25, 30 years later. So, but I don't know whose job it is to do that. That's a good point, Jerry. So
when we cite these, you know, we do these pipelines and we have our GIS maps and such. Is there such thing here? Do we have a record of all these? At
yes.
least the newer ones?
Oh, yeah. They're all on our GIS map.
Yeah. So it does kind of exist. I remember a whole different subject had to do with power lines years ago. We were in legislature working on making somebody keep a file a record of something, and one of the landowners came to me and pointed out, this is why we can't even afford to update our abstracts anymore. You know, everybody, you keep making everybody file this and that and the other thing on these at the courthouse, and then next time you need to update that thing, it costs thousands of dollars.
The difference here, though, is so we have a file here that we keep for existing projects. If you're buying land out by Tioga someday that doesn't have a wind farm on it, how are you ever going to know that that record would exist here?
Yeah, and your attorney is not going to know to look at that.
No.
When we do
I mean, so the only way to do it would be to tie it to
it
the...
It probably is a good idea. It's kind of, again, one of those things. I don't want to get derailed by a legality of you know, if there's some issue with it.
Seems like it's kind of like a deed issue.
Well, Jack, why don't you look into that and see if there's any problems with requiring that?
You mean for a future rule hearing?
Mm-mm.
For this one, the current
yeah.
one? That might be a little bit outside the scope of what we propose up until this point under the current hearing.
Really?
Filing requirements with local county.
Well, I don't know. It seems like this would be the time to do it. So you're just saying the locals would have to make that requirement in their permit?
Well,
their conditional use
with
permit,
title.
Or who can do that? Make the requirement.
This might require a statutory change. I'm gonna have to go back and look at our enacting statute.
Okay.
To see if this is something that we can really delve into.
Okay. Well, why don't you? I mean, that might be a simple question. So.
I would think the registrar's office already has some requirements for what they need to do with easements and stuff like that. They need to file them with them. And so easements are probably showing the locations of the turbines, too. It's something to check with whoever is responsible for that kind of stuff.
Okay.
We can look into it.
Okay. Jerry, you might want to move your mic up a little bit. You talk kind of soft, and I'm sure there's people listening.
So also, Jim wanted to replace topsoil and subsoil with similar soil, and I think that we're requiring that already.
We've been addressing that in the certification order, haven't we?
We don't say anything more than topsoil and subsoil. But I don't know what more you really can say, unless you want to have some specifications on what, you know, define topsoil.
Well, yeah, again, is yeah. similar a term that's used, similar soil, a yeah. term that's used in... Can you define that from a scientific standpoint?
Yeah, I mean, you'd have to have some parameters established to define what's similar.
Mm.
Black dirt.
Yeah.
And I imagine we have those upstairs in the reclamation.
They know more about it than we do.
We know.
Yeah.
We have a way of defining that because they have very strict
right. yeah.
environments, but I don't know how to... I wouldn't know them off the top of my head to try and write them in here, that's for sure.
So now that brings us to 6909-0906, and I put them together with 08, so the decommissioning plan and financial assurance.
So is there really two issues, the incrementalism of it and then the bond ratings? Is that...
I guess it's more than that. It's the whole thing.
Can we take just a short little sure. break because I want to hear this and I got to take this.
Is about a 10-minute recess work?
Sure.
Okay.
Perfect.
Yeah, we'll stand in recess until about... 250 or 255. Okay, we'll start the work session on wind farm decommissioning. Again, where we left off, this is case number PU-17-23. So as I recall, we were just to subsection 06 of the proposed rule, and I had asked whether the two big issues here, I think, Jerry, you'd referenced kind of 06 and 08 were lumped together in the comments as you put them together.
Yeah.
And my understanding, 06 is basically about the incrementalism of how this would be done. And 08 has to do with the bond ratings more, but Maybe I'm not as clear on that as if you look at it differently. Just
yeah, go ahead. I think we had another issue. If you look at Tradewinds, the filing of the decommissioning plan concurrently with the application doesn't provide an accurate cost estimate. If you remember, when we do these things, a lot of times they don't have their turbine picked out yet. And so we approve a plan that could end up using a bigger turbine than the max, and so there's less locations. And so that would mean decommissioning costs are likely less. And then there's other things, too, that change and so forth as they're doing the final planning and the construction. And, you know, we'll approve changes in the site plan, and the site plan ends up different than what they filed with the application.
Well, just to cut to the chase a little bit on these, I thought that someone in here made a suggestion that I thought was kind of interesting. And while it's not in the exact format that I envisioned it, this more of a two-step process, one that would be a bond for construction and one that would be a bond for the facility once it's operational, or financial assurances for both, seems to could potentially have the advantage of providing that incremental coverage that is accurate for the risk involved in each of those two components, while also addressing the issue of the delay in approval that they're concerned about, that we have 6 months to approve this bigger decommissioning plan. So what I was just toying with was a process for construction financial assurances that they would file with their application, and then we would consider that at the hearing. How are they going to cover the costs of reclamation if it fails prior to operation, and that have a plan and an amount that we could review and have discussion with them during the permitting process, and then we would give approval for it in the order, and then they would go out and they'd secure that financial assurances for construction, and it would be defined, that plan would be defined in the permit, and then they would file at construction a decommissioning plan for the whole thing, because then they've have figured out the turbine and they've figured out all those things because they're constructing. And then if it takes us 6 months to review that, we have 6 months or more probably, and then we can give that approval prior to operation, and then that would, and perhaps in there you can do the incremental or not. I need more time to think about how the incremental covers up, you know, once it's operational, whether that's a good idea or not. But having a one phase that's construction reclamation that is included with the permit and approved with the permit and settled before construction sort of addresses that issue and frees them from the concern that we're going to drag out construction because we haven't approved a full decommissioning plan for the whole thing once it's operational.
Yeah, I liked that a lot because they're always in a hurry with these things. And the thought that maybe we have a problem with their decommissioning plan and it lingers on as we have a hearing and debate those costs.
The 10%, though, I didn't necessarily know where they came up with that 10% of construction.
I think it was just a general percentage.
And I wouldn't want to commit to that.
That would, and you know, actually, I thought it was a bit high.
Mm. Well, that we don't have any experience to base that on, so I'd want to be able to look at it during a hearing and talk about it, and then they could justify what their costs are going to be and what the appropriate coverage level was. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't want to lock us into a certain figure for that right now when we've never even done a single one of these.
Well, if you look at a wind farm and the thing goes for $250 million, 10% would put them at a $25 million bond. The estimates we've been getting in are less than that on decommissioning expenses with the plans that we've got so far, a lot less than that.
I disagree with that, Jerry.
Would you?
We don't need to decommission the whole thing, though, Jerry. We're just talking about for construction, right. So I think it's important not to mix the two. You just need to, we need to have enough to cover the decommissioning of what's happening during construction.
And I like the idea of just having a number out there that they file. It's a temporary bond. The 10% works for me. But it's of their construction costs. And then when they file their application with it, they just file a bond.
You know, so I don't, I'm not going to dismiss your idea. In fact, I think it probably is reasonable in light of keeping things moving along. Mm-hmm. Now, yeah, they always want to go quick, but so does everybody else. You know, the whole rest of the world, when they're seeking government permits and approvals, pipelines would love to go get things done in a few weeks or a month or two, but it's just not the way it works, and it's just a reality, and we have a responsibility for the long term here. I think I am okay with doing something that, you know, less than the whole amount so that it can be approved as part of the siting procedure. And then while they're, from the time the siting becomes effective, and I suppose sometime shortly after that, they choose their equipment from there until they're into construction. But before they go into commercial production, they would have that time to get their estimates and bring it to us to get something approved. I think that sounds reasonable. But I'm going to point out here two things. The last set of estimates that I see, and I think for the wind farm averaged out to well over $200,000 a turbine. In fact, $280,000 is in my mind. And so that one seemed to be a lot more than past estimates. Mm. And I will also point out that some of these folks that are in such a hurry on these have been screaming for parity for the last couple of months. And I will just point out in the case of a mine, once they start disrupting, their bond will be in place for the worst case scenario. They do not get to even remove topsoil without enough bond to replace all the subsoil all the way down to the coal level and completely redo it. And so I think, you know, we're being pretty generous here actually. But I don't object to that, but it's not going to be some real minimal amount either that if they go out and as some of these plans are coming in where we want approval now, we're going to do some stuff. But the one that I looked at recently didn't intend to start production until 2019, and I don't remember. I think it was even the end of 2019. In that much time, they can have done a lot of construction, and if something better comes along and they want to move a different direction, we could have an enormous cleanup cost in the state. And so the construction part of it is going to need to be significant, though, and enough to make sure that we can do our job.
So now, did you go through the comments filed on the financing, this one, by, that's not the right one.
I kind of read through them as background. I think that's what they were intended, if we're talking about the same thing. Back to the $28
million. Hold on, Jerry.
$280 million.
All the financing stuff, Randy, where, they made a pretty solid case that there isn't a real likely scenario that there's going to be construction on one of these and that's abandoned because they don't start constructing until they have a PPA in place.
Yeah.
So, you know, I didn't.
That might dig some holes. Make a couple little roads.
Renewable energy financing and cost recovery from Molly Smith, NL, and Tradewind submitted that. So, anyway, I just...
It's an interesting read on how projects are financed and work, and it goes towards the idea that they're not going to walk away from them. They can't walk away from them.
It also underscores, though, how the people who are their creditors are definitely going to get paid first. So it also, while it says they're not going to walk away, it sort of underscores the need for financial assurances, because there's going to be a lot of people in line for any money.
And that was the argument that we heard before when we set the 10-year requirement on requiring a bond, is that during that first 10 years, their bills are coming in high. And then in the second 10, after that 10-year period, is when they start seeing their return on it. And so they have more money to get a bond. So that was kind of what we were sold, that and the likelihood that they wouldn't abandon the project early.
So anyway.
But if I could point out, if you had $280,000 per turbine, then if there were 100 turbines there, that would be $28 million total. And so if you're looking at the 10% number, that would mean that the project would cost $280 million for 100 turbines. Mm. I think $280 million might be low for 100 turbines, and 100 turbines might be high anymore because the turbines are getting bigger.
Mm-hmm.
And we're looking at like the 300-megawatt projects. That would be 3-megawatt turbines if you had 100 of them. And then you're going to be costing more than $280 million, way more. So the 10% is within a range of being reasonable. And another thought on that is that it might be a little high, and maybe it should be a little high, because you'd like for them to have the incentive afterwards to get their plan filed and reduce the amount of their bond. And especially if you go to an incremental bond where they only have to have like 25% initially, then they're going to reduce the bond significantly. And that,
but even at that $280,000, that is their statement.
Yeah.
You know, we've never cleaned one up.
Yep.
We got to make sure we have enough.
Yep, I agree. And so the 10% is a flexible number here. I mean, you can up it a little bit if you want, 15%. But then you don't have to even worry about it during siting. They have to file it up front.
Well, if we're going to go this direction, that certainly eases it, so it shouldn't require new hearings or anything, although maybe the public would...
After they file their plan, we still might have hearings.
No, I'm talking about as far as this rules change.
Yeah. yeah.
I want to review before I would commit to some minimal amount for construction would be. Review some cases and look at them a little bit.
Okay.
Yeah, and I'm not finding that 10% of the project cost, Jerry, as the... I thought I saw...
Tradewinds?
Yeah, I believe that was Tradewind.
Oh, this is Redview.
Is there a suggestion for what to set it at?
And it was 10% of construction?
Yeah. For 10% of construction costs... And then after construction, set incrementally, 25% after 5 years.
Not of construction.
Remaining 50% after 10 years.
Yeah, but, Jerry, that's of decommissioning costs.
10% of construction costs. When we cite the thing, they tell us what they're going to spend on it, what it's going to cost, and we set the filing fee based on that. They would have the decommissioning bond based on that number as well.
Well, as for me, as far as that, the decommissioning part of it, I will not see myself going along with that, but I will see myself potentially going along with something less during construction so they have time to put together a decommissioning plan from a PE, and we can look at that for the decommissioning plan.
I don't believe it's Tradewind. I think it was actually Red Butte that discussed that under page 2 of their comments.
On the 10%?
Which one, Red Butte?
For some reason, I thought maybe they did. That's where they speak to the...
Red Butte says they support Tradewind's proposal.
Okay.
But suggests an alternate increment of 10% per year instead of 25, 25, 50.
I was seeing under, if you look in the second paragraph under... page 2, where they talk about the 60,000 per wind turbine mm-hmm. would be sufficient if construction was never completed. So that's why I thought maybe they had the 10% in there.
I'm not finding it. I remember reading it.
Another alternative would be for the owner to provide financial assurance equal to 10% of the total decommissioning cost.
See, that's the thing. Decommissioning cost, not construction cost. So that's a big difference.
So as I read the Tradewinds one, it was 10% of your construction costs, which was project costs.
You'll have to go back and double check, Jerry. I think I'm not sure that's what they wrote.
Jack, do you think you're close enough that you understand a kind of a concept to put forward?
Yeah, I think I understand the concept that you guys are speaking of. I'll have to double
that they would in a siting application. I'm going to repeat it to see if we're on the same track here. Okay. In a siting application, they would come in with some lesser amount than total decommissioning mm-hmm. costs, so that because they haven't chosen a turbine yet or that sort of thing, and we'll have to figure out what that is or what it's even based on. But that would be something that would be approved as part of the siting process then. And then from that point on, as they finally choose a turbine design and initiate their construction, it will be incumbent upon them to go out and get the estimates from a PE and bring them in and of the total decommissioning and get that approved by the commission before they commence commercial operation.
And the financial assurances at that time.
Right.
And you're saying you're not open to any incremental over the, like, incremental building up of the bond.
I think it's a bad
idea. Once it's operational.
Actually, it was proposed.
What do you mean it was proposed?
In our rule that we would allow it.
Yeah, and that, as I viewed it, was to address the construction issue more than... That was my read and my intention on that language. So this would be going a slightly different way,
okay.
You know, recognizing breaking out two separate processes. But what's the theory behind allowing a, you know, like they're suggesting, one of them 25% the first 3 years and then adding on incrementally until you get to the full cost over 10?
I think it's the same theory that we had originally until it went out 10 years, but it just gives you some bond up front in case something happens.
But there really is no... Is there any justification for that? Is the risk lower on the first few years, or what would the justification be for staggering it like that? I mean, I can see the justification on construction because they don't need... to cover for reclamation on 100 towers that aren't in the ground.
Jerry, if I recall from your conversation or our conversations regarding bonding, that would the higher bond up front would increase the cost to the company.
Yeah.
And so by having a smaller amount, usually it's based off the percentage of the bond, would be a lower amount.
Well, yeah, I can understand that. But, I mean, I can understand why they want that, but is there justification for it? Is the risk less? I mean, when we're protecting...
The only justification is that you're not expecting to have to retire this thing until it's like 25 years old.
Wasn't the 10-year thing years ago, though, based on the assumption they'd be getting PTCs for 10 years, and so what could go wrong?
It was a factor, but you know, when their PTC credits go away, then they have less money. But their financing and stuff was usually set up in such a way that lenders and all of that stuff were getting paid during the first 10 years. And it's talked about in there in the Tradewinds financing comments.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a flip where the people start, the investment that they first put in is kind of paid off, then they're starting to earn money on the project after the 10 years.
You know, I did appreciate all that explanation on the financing, but it led me to the conclusion that there's a lot of institutional financers out there that are protecting their interest. One of those interests is not decommissioning. And so if things go belly up, which is the whole point of all of this planning, then we've, you know, put a lot of faith in their work to investigate the financial strength of these companies, and they've protected themselves by being the first payers, and you know, they get to collect all the assets to pay off their debts. And so in the end, where are the assets for the people for reclamation?
And I think what their position is that there's no way you can walk away from this thing in the early stages. There's too much money out there.
Again, you can never say never. You just can't, you know, too big to fail. It's just, that's why we have this sort of thing. And the first time it happens, everyone goes, geez, we never thought that could happen.
Well, you know,
there's so much money out there, but if it's somebody else's hands, they're holding it, it doesn't help you any.
Yeah, I think like a tornado or something could come through and level the place. And in that case, there should be insurance.
Right.
But I'm not really seeing anything that they wouldn't fix and continue operations. There's just too much money there.
We're not regulating their insurance, though. We're not regulating their ability to recover.
Yeah, I understand
it. It kind of reminds me of the Texas oil plug case where the state got dropped down with $53 million, and that was just based upon a promise of the companies. It was essentially, there was no performance bonds in place, and so they were just going on the company's promises, but then the state and the landowners ended up paying for almost all of it.
Right.
Without having that bond up front. But I'm not sure how that really changes the risk level from being on year 10 to being out at the beginning. I can understand how it's financially better for the company.
Yeah. Yep. But, well, the risk of having to decommission the thing is definitely lower when it's new.
Sure, that makes sense.
Yep.
Less likely to have equipment failures, and if there was, they'd probably be under warranty of some sort and that sort of thing. The contracts, power purchase agreements are in place for 20 years or... So. Anyway,
really
stuff
sure
to think
works,
about.
So what we wanted...
Bonding prices must reflect that too.
Right.
You know, I'm guessing that it probably costs more to acquire bond for a facility that is nearing the end of its useful life and having break down problems and things like that than it is one that's brand new, too. So I bet you the cost's a lot different, too.
So did we say then we're going to determine the amount of the bond during the siting, the initial bond during the siting process, and then the final amount for the bond construction plan to be filed and decided before it goes operational?
Yep.
Approved by the commission.
Yep. And on that first one, I'm open to some predetermined. I initially wasn't, but I think you made some good points, Jerry, on a predetermined amount. So if
I like it.
If we can simplify it further by just saying here's the amount you have to file for construction and get us your construction reclamation plan and we'll approve it during the siting hearing, then, you know,
yeah,
just determining what that amount is.
Yeah, I suggested a while back in one of these sessions that we just make it a percentage of construction cost, period. And then it's probably a bit much more than it needs to be, and then we don't have to worry about the proceedings to try and set it. Because, mm-hmm. you know, if you're contesting those proceedings, it'd be tough.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, you have some stuff for that, right?
Yep. Could I just get one clarification? So with regards to the incremental bond, the commission isn't looking to have that taken into consideration, like a 10% per year or 25%, 25%, 50% upon year 10?
If you leave
I
it
didn't
as...
see one that I loved that really made a lot of, you know, like you, I could follow the logic on it. But
if you leave what was proposed in the rule, I think it does allow that.
True.
It does,
yep.
On page 9.
Yeah.
And you could do it when you decide what their bond is. You could determine then whether you wanted to give it incrementally or.
Yeah. That's
a good way.
I'm just pointing out, just because it's in here,
yeah.
I don't anticipate me supporting one.
Okay.
For their ultimate plan at less than the full amount. But it is in here that the commission would have that option.
Yep. So that's probably a good way to leave it, and then we can see, and again, on the case-by-case basis, once we get more familiar with this stuff.
But when one comes up, I do not intend to sit quietly when someone says, well, but it's built in here, so you must have anticipated doing it, because I don't anticipate doing it.
Right. Okay.
But it is an option for...
Mm-hmm. That simplifies things for us too, not having to try to figure out what that incremental might be and entertain it and just leave it the way it is.
And if you like, Jerry and I can sit down and try to dig into more to the financial assurance part with the I guess the benefits of or the risk from doing incremental bonding.
I don't think you need to, because they'll make those justifications when they file their bonds, and we can have those conversations at the time if that's the course that they take. So if you guys can come up with some rationale for a predetermined construction bond, I think that would be good, and what it would be, what the level would be.
So our next commenter on the list here is MDU. And they do their cost estimates in-house. And if you require a professional engineer to do the estimates, it could increase their costs of repairing them. They suggest instead that the qualifications of the engineer be provided for the commission to accept or reject the estimate provided by the company.
That one was surprising to me that they don't have professional engineers.
I'm thinking they do, but I'm thinking that they have somebody that's not registered doing this.
But couldn't it be signed off by one of the registered folks?
Yep.
Where is that in the rule? Is it in 06?
It was on the... estimate.
I think it was under 06. I think it's the very last...
Frankly, I think it really should have been a third party, but a PE is not going to want to risk their licensure, I suppose. So I'm okay with the way it is. But, you know, when I look at estimates that have been turned into us with what we have at this point, you have fairly similar systems that are not even comparable in what they estimate. And so to not require that it be a third party, not require that it be a PE, to just say, well, whatever you tell us, we're going to accept it, if I think is irresponsible on our part too. And so they can do a lot of the work in-house, and I do not see, you know, when we're talking about projects that are $100 million and some multiple hundreds of millions of dollars, that we should be cutting corners on these estimates, and I think it should be a responsible PE doing it.
Just in terms of scheduling, Randy, how long did you want to go today? We had scheduled till 2:30.
I think we're just about done.
No, we got all the credit rating stuff to talk about.
Do you need to leave?
By 1:45. Okay.
Let's go quicker. And
okay,
are you okay with leaving the PE?
I am. Yeah.
Okay. So. No change on that one.
Hit big points, Jerry.
We already talked about Red Butte there. NextEra says bond ratings should take into account local bonding requirements, so you don't end up having to double bond or have two different bonds for it. I think that is something that you can take into account when you set their bond requirement.
Yeah, I agree. I know Randy disagrees, but I agree that they should get credit for their local bond if it's required.
So what do we do if, let's say,
we've not addressed it,
one has, I don't know, $5 million of local bonding, and we ultimately determine that there's $15 million of liability there. So we just require the extra 10. And something happens, and this goes under, and the county decides that they're not that concerned about it. They're going to use their bonding to help make the school and the road department whole that they had planned on with the tax revenues from this. And now we've got $10 million for a $15 million project. What are we going to do about that?
Well, first of all, I can't imagine the local people deciding to abandon and leave all those windmills in place. So that seems like a really unlikely scenario.
If they don't know, their property taxes go up.
Yeah, and they look at a bunch of rusty old windmills in their backyard.
I think
they're the ones that are going to want the reclamation the most.
I think they're going to say that's the PSE's job. That's who the legislature said should, I can't remember the terms in the law that sets this all up, that we should set up a decommissioning plan.
Why would they have a bond for decommissioning then? I mean, I guess I would want to know in the discussion what the bond that they set forth was to cover and how much, and they'd have to show us proof of it, and it would be then, you know, something that we could consider if we felt it was to cover reclamation, and if there was any, you know, gray areas, we could reinforce, you know, through something that's what it has to be obligated for, that's what our understanding is, or something. But I can't imagine a local community taking the money and leaving the structures. So I don't think it's fair to require. If they have a bond in place for reclamation at the county level, I do not think it's fair or reasonable to require, to ignore that bond and require the total bond again from us.
I'm okay with the county transitioning that over to us, but I am very uncomfortable relying on the counties to do what I think is our job.
I guess we'd have to see at the time when they bring it forward. It's not, we don't specify one way or another in our rules, do we? That we will or will not consider it?
We don't bring it up at all.
So why did they comment about that?
I think they're concerned about having to pay bonds in two places.
Okay,
so...
No change?
We'll kind of leave that hanging at this point.
I think there might have just been some concern that it would not fall under another form of financial assurance that is acceptable. So they were just looking for that clarification.
Mm. Capital Power opposes assurance requirements before construction as unnecessary economic burden that will hinder development and runs counter to industry norm, as most do not require assurance until 10 to 15 years.
Yeah, and wind on the wires, so we can combine those two, but I don't.
Yeah.
I think we've already talked through that. We don't need to belabor it. We disagree. And I would expect that other states will follow suit down the road.
And so, Wind and Wire said the same thing, and they went and gave some examples of what's required around the place, and they said that these rules will make us out of step with requirements in the other states, and we compete for projects with them. And so the other states will get projects from us.
Jerry, didn't I send you a list of other states, though, that require financial assurances prior to construction?
Yep, it goes both ways.
I noticed all the states they cite here are kind of like non-mining states that probably don't have much experience with a project going down and the state having a mess to mop up.
Yeah.
I believe Wyoming is one of them that requires it prior to construction.
Yep.
Okay. The Mills family, bonding should be incremental. Another Doan's family supports bonding before construction. Okay. The A bond rating. NextEra requiring anything more than investment grade for self-bonding unnecessarily increases costs. BBB1 for S&P Fitch and Baa3 for Moody's is what investment grade is. They should also consider credit rating agency issuer ratings, and also if A rating, then should specify to allow for an A- rating instead of making A the minimum. If you mean A- is acceptable, we need to say that. The Mills family also supported an investment grade requirement, and Capital Power, A rating, arbitrary and unnecessary, will hinder development. Investment grade consistent with requirements for posting security in most electric power markets, including MISO for posting credit through parent guarantees. MISO has requirements to get credit during their billing and stuff like that, that you have a certain rating, and it's investment grade. So they were quoting that.
I would have a hard time going down to the bottom of the investment grade barrel, which is not real strong on this, and not doing the same for the mining companies. And we're not going to be doing that for the mining companies anytime soon. I think that NextEra had a very good point, although I thought it was clear enough, but maybe it's not. When we say A ratings, I thought, just like if you say double A means double A plus, double A, or double A minus.
Yeah.
And A means A plus, A, or A minus. But when we say A ratings, one of the things NextEra said here, also, if an A rating, then it should specify to allow an A minus. And that was my intent. And so if that needs specificity, that Standard & Poor's A minus, or Fitch A minus, or a Moody's A3 is not just part of the A's, then I'm okay with specifying that.
There was some language suggested in one of the comments.
It was about base and electric. They suggested
categories. A category or something like
yeah,
that.
I forgot to mark that one. I thought Basin had mentioned it too, but I can't find it now. But I know NextEra, while their comments were for going lower yet, but they also mm-hmm. did mention that if we stick with A minus would be important.
I don't. I haven't had time to talk with outside folks to get a better understanding of the ratings. So I wanted to do that and.
Okay.
And still consider this component of the rules. So,
okay. I'm just going to read something.
Maybe our new commissioner will have some insights on finance and bond ratings.
From through Wikipedia, the bond rating companies, and get the graphic and the explanation. The when you go to the B's, the highest set of B's, the obligor has adequate capacity to meet its financial commitments. However, adverse economic conditions or changing circumstances are more likely to lead to a weakened capacity of the obligor to meet its financial commitments. I think that the fact that OMS has researched this with a lot more research capabilities than we have and determined that they don't want these on the mine sites with less than an A. And we have emulated that already in one reclamation area. I think it's a rock solid pattern to go by.
Yeah, well, you aren't going to have trouble with the A rating. I mean, from a
solid
standpoint, I just do think that I want to know if it's a necessary standard, if there's, what the protections are for the others. And I want to talk to some folks in the financial markets and get a better understanding of those.
There was some comments that none of the wind developers can get an A.
Right. Yeah,
is they got too much. It takes too much debt to finance these things, and it's just the nature of the game.
Mm-hmm. So those are facts I want to take into consideration and get more information from folks in the financial industry on what the ratings mean and what kind of protection they provide, and then also what the differences might be between mining and wind generation that would potentially argue for a higher rating for mining, if there is such a, if that's the case. I don't know. I'm not saying there is. I just don't know. Maybe there is.
It's more money.
Yeah, I have a little bit of literature with regard to that, Commissioner. I can pass it on to you. And I think that was based on an EPA study. But it wasn't for wind farms. It wasn't for mine reclamation as well. I think it was for waste facilities that they found the ability to restore, that it was very safe within those top A grade ratings. But I can pass it along to you.
I think I looked at, did you send that already?
I think we have used it in the past for something else, though. So you might have referred to it before.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be curious what NextEra has. Might want to check on that.
Have coal mines?
No, for a rating.
Oh, for a rating.
I think they're the most financially sound.
Sounds to me like they have an A-.
Do they?
Well, they suggested that if it's going to an A, please make it A-. So.
It will be.
That was my conclusion anyway.
Is that all of the things? The discussion points?
Yeah. And we just summarized the written comments. I mean, I didn't summarize what was said during the hearings.
Right. No, that was helpful. Good.
I think there's one last thing that NextEra did say. They did put some comments in with regards to the tangible net worth of at least $10 million in the ratio, and how that's unnecessary.
Didn't they suggest rather than they suggested something totally different?
Yeah, something not based on ratios, if I remember.
Right, they got rid. They wanted to get rid of the ratio and instead look at their tangible net worth.
Right.
Would offer more protection than other financial metrics in a default and recovery scenarios because of, and so that was something else I wanted to talk to some folks in the financial world about. So those are not terms that I've used and are familiar with. So, do you have any sense on the tangible net worth and how that might be different from the, or better?
I don't, except for just, the fact that we've kind of relied on OSM's guidance on that and and making sure that we're solid in that regard. And so I have a great reluctance to stray from it because it's been working.
We don't always look to the federal government to be like the model of how best to do things. So I'm not, are we completely confident in OSM? I mean, just when did they establish this? And does it apply to wind?
I think the NXTER actually said a higher tangible net worth.
Yeah, they wanted to go up to 100 million.
Well, they're worth a lot.
Right.
And we can't make it exclusive to just one company either, but I suppose we could.
Well, no, but you could throw it out there. They're suggesting throw it out there, and then they'd be covered. Would that be an option for us to consider as, when we say you have to provide this, any variety of financial assurances, couldn't they propose that? Or do we specify they have to have all of them?
I think we had said it as this or this or this, didn't we, in the rule?
Yep, one of three. However, even if we took that out completely and they weren't going on the bond rating and they weren't going, didn't have the public utility exception, it's not as if that wouldn't be something that the commission couldn't request. I mean, it is a may except these self-repair guarantees.
Right.
If they want to bolster their ability to be their own guarantor, then, I mean, I'm sure that would be a good fact to bring up.
Oh. They have to have all three of them, though.
You want to be careful not to be competitively neutral here, too.
Right. But, again, offering some flexibility for them to, any of the companies to.
But, well, first of all, I mean, they can always do some kind of bond or something. This is all just about if they choose to go the self-guarantee or parent guarantee route. And then if they do that, it's saying, I believe it's saying that it's the guarantor has to meet at least one of the following, the A rating or the tangible net worth part, or then the electric public utility.
Yeah.
Yeah. And their point in number two of those is that they want it just to be the tangible net worth, not all three of those things under number two.
So maybe they're not an A minus rating. Maybe that's the one going on. But
maybe they aspire to be. Okay, so we'll come back to that at the next one.
I think it's something that has worked not only in North Dakota but around the country for a long time based on the OSM standards. And I don't necessarily agree with everything the federal government does, but some things that have worked for decades sometimes are a pretty good proven model until you hear some really good reason why it's not. Okay, so we'll schedule another work session fairly soon, though, so we can keep this moving along.
So will we schedule that during our scheduling meeting on Wednesday?
I expect.
Okay.
So we could add it for you?
Yeah, why don't you?
To schedule it.
Yep.
Okay.
Okay.
We're wrapped up. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, everyone.